Support for WAER Original Podcasts comes from California Closets of Syracuse, located in DeWitt. California Closets can help you get your entire home organized with custom-designed storage solutions for the home office, kitchen pantry, closets, and more. Online at californiaclosets.com.
Popular culture is almost by definition everywhere. We encounter it in the morning newspaper, the afternoon radio show, the evening television, and in a host of books, comics, and magazines in between. Of course, developments in digital culture have made that popular media even more ubiquitous. Most of us have almost instantaneous access to popular culture 24 hours a day through the digital devices we carry in our pocket. In some ways, this constant access to information, entertainment, and social networks can be a good thing. It keeps us connected. But in other ways, this access may pose dangers by endlessly confronting us with images that can be hurtful, traumatic, and even oppressive. This is particularly true for those whose identities are already marginalized because of their race, ethnicity, gender, or sexual orientation. I'm Kendall Phillips, and on this episode of Pop Life, we'll be exploring the positives and negatives of this ubiquity of media in our lives. Our guide through this complex and ambivalent terrain is a renowned journalist and media educator, Dr. Sherry Williams. Dr. Williams is a professor in the School of Communication at American University, and in 2021 was awarded the National Association of Black Journalists Educator of the Year Award. Sherry, welcome to Pop Life.
Thank you for having me, Kendall.
So excited to have you, and such an admirer of your work. And for me, one of the things that I think is really brilliant about your kind of critical engagement with popular culture, with digital media, with the news, is the way you engage that ambivalence. We can certainly see a lot of negatives in our popular culture and digital culture, and we can also see a lot of positives. And I really admire the way your work kind of keeps moving back and forth between those sides. And I'm wondering, in that way, how do you kind of, for yourself, kind of make sense of the ambivalent, the kind of two sides of the coin of our contemporary sort of popular culture?
Well, I really tend to think of digital culture and popular culture, and specifically social media, in a framework of traditional media, right? So by that, I mean, there have been particular ways in which mainstream media, particularly television, fictional and nonfiction, and print media have depicted people like me, right? Working class people, Black people, fat people, people from the Midwest. So there have been, and at the intersection at all of those, you know, all of those groups that I represent, and those groups individually and all together in one intersection have either been totally erased by mainstream traditional media, or have been trivialized, debased, and disrespected. So when I think of social media and digital media, I think of the ways in which people can use those platforms to break through the typical agenda setting and framing of mainstream media and tell stories directly to the audience that they want to connect with, without leaning into those stereotypes and social constructions that we have typically seen. But at the same time, the same people who have developed these traditional forms of media that we've used for so long, some of those stereotypes and social constructions that they've worked with are some of the same stereotypes and social constructions that, like, the people who create the algorithms that run these different social networking sites, those are embedded in them also. So I do think it's important for us to really understand that there are ways that we can tell our own stories through these mediums that weren't necessarily created for us to do that, but at the same time, recognize the harm that they cause.
Yeah, I think on the second point, you know, what I find interesting, you know, as an older person looking at social media as, I would say, kind of an outsider in some ways to digital culture, but in some ways how much of the contemporary digital culture, and I'm thinking like things like TikTok and YouTube and Instagram and Twitter, really have started to look like old traditional media. Like, I see very, very similar kinds of images, kinds of stereotypes. And I know in some of your work, you've sort of delved into not just the circulation of those kind of stereotypical images and difficult images and kind of mainstream media images, but also the consequences. You use a wonderful phrase in one of your essays about a kind of stream of sadness of traumatic images. And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about the damage that's done to people who are still now not just seeing the mainstream media images or stereotypes, but surrounded by them, you know, on an almost 24-hour day basis.
Yeah, so when you mentioned stream of sadness, that is related to this journal article that I have that was published in the academic journal Feminist Media Studies. So what I wanted to explore was how there is this generation of young people, particularly young Black people, who are not only over-indexed in social media, and they're immersed in social media a lot and see a lot of social media images, but they're also really vulnerable to police violence at the same time, right? So there is a situation where we have these young Black people who are watching images of people like them being killed by police and brutalized by police on social media all the time. But then in real life, they really are vulnerable to that kind of police violence. So I wanted to take a look at how this group who is still developing their identity and figuring out who they are and what they want to be and how what their place is going to be in this world, if they're constantly seeing these kinds of images, what kind of impact will that have on them? So some colleagues and I, when I was a postdoc at Wake Forest, we started interviewing young Black people in the Triad area of North Carolina. And I took some of those interviews and just focused specifically on some of the young women that I interviewed, because what I wanted to do was not only get an idea from them of how watching these images of Black death on social media were having an impact on them, but I also wanted to center the gendered experience of young Black women. Because as a country, when we, in this past decade, when we've been talking a lot more about police violence, we really have focused the conversation exclusively almost on cisgender Black men. But we know that Black women, cisgender, transgender, and even non-gender conforming Black folks are also victims of police violence and survivors of it. So I wanted to focus on them. But what the respondents talked about was constantly seeing the impact. The respondents talked about images of people like them being killed, being harassed, being brutalized in these ways in which had a long lasting impact on them.
Because it must be a very difficult bind, and you write about this, both to feel, as I think these young women seem to feel, a kind of obligation to look, to bear witness to, as you say, their lived experience, the experience of generations, this kind of cultural generational memory. So there's an obligation to witness this, but also to be confronted with it in such an endless stream of not only multiple scenes of violence, but even multiple iterations. So the reproduction of those images, the videos of George Floyd, the images of so many people who've been murdered by police brutality. And I'm wondering if that's part of, you know, their struggle is to want to be politically active and conscious and part of that struggle, but also recognize the cost that that entails to their personal psyche.
Yeah, and that's what they talked about too. So, and not to get like too media studies with this, but one of the things that I did in that study was apply this older mass communication theory called cultivation by George Gerbner, which was developed in the 1970s, which really talks about how prolonged use of television does really shape our idea of society and what we should expect and who we even think we should be in it. But then there's one concept inside of cultivation that talks about resonance and how if people watch content that resonates with their real life, that they will even feel it even a little bit deeper. So that's something that I apply to that, because it also illustrated what some of the people, some of the young women in the study were saying. So you might recall DeJera Becton, who was body slammed by a police officer at a pool party in Texas when she was 15 years old. And she was, you know, a young girl, young Black girl wearing braids who was really petite in a bikini. And the whole world, the whole country saw her manhandled by this police officer who was pinning her down to the ground as she was lying on her stomach with his knee on her back. So he was pinning her to the ground that way, and her face was in the grass. I remember one respondent in particular who said that even though she's older, she said she looked just like me. I have a small frame like hers. I wear braids like she does sometimes. And just seeing her calling for her mother, screaming for her mother, and really being helpless and vulnerable and being brutalized at that time, the respondent said that I, at that point in time, I knew that something like this could happen to me. I knew that that I would be vulnerable to this kind of violence too. So she talked about having to turn away, as a matter of fact, right? So there was the wanting to be informed, but also having to turn away because the resonance was so strong and the trauma was so strong that she just really, in the face of needing to be informed, just couldn't really take the visual trauma anymore. There's a real complex dynamic that exists here, and that really has, especially in some of these most recent years that have passed, when we really have seen a lot more images of police brutality, especially around between like 2014 and 16, when there were so many that were coming out at a fast pace. But they have really been reckoning with, how do I share this information in an effort to amplify it and get more attention and eyes on this, and eventually, hopefully, justice, but also not traumatize myself and traumatize others at the same time. So some of the respondents were saying that they purposefully would start to look away from the videos, or if they learned of someone who was brutalized by police or killed by police, they would opt to not watch the videos anymore. But really, because if someone's name came up as a hashtag, they would on purpose not look at the video, but go look for a story, a news story, whether it was broadcast or digital. So they were still seeking to find information about these deaths, these racialized deaths, but they didn't want to necessarily see the death itself.
Sure.
Because it was just too traumatic.
Of course, yeah, that need for the self-care. But I'm wondering, you know, thinking about that and thinking about cultivation theory, and I admire you using traditional media. I think, you know, new media doesn't necessarily need all new tools. But I'm wondering if one of the ways maybe the cultivation, the way this media is cultivating a worldview, when we look at sort of the world of social media, that maybe is a little bit different, maybe twofold. One is that it is so ubiquitous. You know, it is in our pockets. It's constantly there. But I'm also wondering, you know, for your respondents or just your perspective, does it change things when the same platform that I'm getting fashion news or new music releases or any of the other kind of pop culture elements that flow through our TikTok or our Instagram or our Twitter is also in the same place we're also getting these often very traumatic political images? Does that blending and mixing make it harder to have self-care?
Yeah, I think it does. And one of the things that the respondents talked about too was how unexpected those images were, right? And especially I think of, and especially some of those deaths were happening during the summer. And I even think about myself. So in the summer of 2016, you know, I wasn't in the classroom, wasn't working, you know, consistently all the time, but I couldn't sleep one night. It was 2 a.m. I'm lying in the bed and I grab my phone and I'm just scrolling through and I see this image of this man in his car, and his white t-shirt becomes soaked in blood, and his girlfriend and another voice who is off camera are just screaming. I didn't know what I was looking at, but later I realized that was part of the video that Diamond Reynolds recorded when after Philando Castile was shot. But it was, I was so jarred and just shocked by it. That was actually the genesis of the Stream of Sadness study, because I was thinking, mm-hmm. if I, as a 40-something year old Generation Xer who already couldn't sleep, like really, I stayed up probably another 8 hours after that because I really couldn't sleep then. And I was just thinking, this is summertime. And if I am so traumatized by this right now, I can imagine how a 14, 15, 16 year old who doesn't have the same maturity and mental capacity as I do, how might they navigate what they just saw? And to be honest, I was thinking about some of my little cousins who I knew were not in school because it was the summertime and maybe, you know, scrolling around on their phone. So that actually became the genesis of this study, just simply because it was, I mean, I was scrolling through and seeing pictures of people at the beach, of their babies, of their food. And then all of a sudden there's this video of this guy who was just shot by a police officer and who ended up dying. And that's part of what the respondents were talking about too, is just like the absolute surprise, and not just the surprise, but the sporadic nature of Black death and how it ends up circulating on social media. Because again, you might be seeing a fashion spread or a cooking demonstration or some video of a celebrity talking about their experiences. And then all of a sudden, a video in which a Black person is being brutalized or killed by a police officer. So one of the things that respondents in the study were saying back then is that they wanted to see social media companies take more responsibility for what was circulating on their networks. And since then, there have been more warnings that have come out, and specifically on, I've seen on Instagram and Twitter, when there is sensitive or material that might be perceived as sensitive and violent, it's kind of grayed out or blurred out first, and then you have to opt in to see it. But that just automatic circulation is something that that respondents were saying that they really wanted to see less of, and they wanted to see social media networks take responsibility for.
Yeah, well, it's nice to see them starting to take responsibility. But I'm wondering, you're not only a brilliant and astute student of media and a scholar studying critically what the message is circulating, but you are also, as I noted in the introduction, an award-winning educator. And so I'm wondering if you have an advice for some of our listeners who may have these kinds of young people in their family, in their life, who will be subjected to these kinds of images, this kind of trauma that you're talking about. Are there suggestions you have for, you know, ways we can help our young people and ourselves sort of navigate this sometimes traumatic terrain of social media in the contemporary age?
Yeah, so it's really interesting that you asked me that question, because I teach a class called Identity, Power, and Misrepresentation here at American University in Washington, D.C. And in that class, we just talked about yesterday, and they read about social media societal influence. And we talked about algorithms and the algorithms of oppression, the book by Sophia Noble. Mm. And one of the things that we talked about is what people can do to combat this on their own. And as a class, we talked about just as individuals being mindful of the things that may trigger us. So for example, we talked about unfollowing accounts that might tend to be distributors of information that makes that might make a user feel a certain type of way. And when I say a certain type of way, I'm not even really talking about like the trauma that people might see from seeing violence on social media, or it might even be like a visual or aesthetic kind of content that might make people feel like they are comparing their body type to someone else, who might be severely airbrushed, or even, you know, someone who has a particular body shape because they paid for it. And I'm, you know, I don't have any problem with plastic surgery or what people want to do with their bodies. But also, if we have young people looking at these images, they're not always aware of how, if someone has an envious body, we don't know how they got it. But knowing how they got it, including if they are someone who has gone through body modification, or if someone has used filters, like, we just don't know that. We're just looking at this content and comparing ourselves. So we talked about unfollowing accounts that might be detrimental to our mental health, even making sure that we're not constantly clicking on content that might have a detrimental impact on our mental health, because the algorithm will continue to feed us what we look at. And also, we discussed just not just being mindful of how we are using social media, but also being mindful of how often we use it too, and really instituting real social media breaks for yourself, and being really intentional about how we are using social media and who we're following and the kinds of content that we're engaging with, and also making sure that there is a balance, right? So if we are spending a certain amount of time on social media, let's make sure that we're balancing that out with reading content, or maybe even watching content that can offset some of the negativity that we might be seeing. So I think there are some real ways that we can make sure that social media isn't harmful for us. But I think, honestly, parents just really need to learn more about social media as a whole, and learn more about these networks, and just really see what kind of content that their children might be exposed to. And when I say children, I am talking about actual children, but even teenagers and young adults, because, I mean, you talk about yourself being older. I am older too. I'm a Generation Xer. I didn't grow up with all of this technology, even though I'm really interested in it now. But I'm not one of those digital natives. I mean, I basically come from the VCR and the Walkman era, right?
Yes.
So this is not my wheelhouse in terms of me growing up with this. But there's some really interesting ways that people are using social media to tap into young people's vulnerabilities. And I think if parents knew that, they would be more engaged and maybe more insightful and mindful, and being more observatory about the ways that the young people in their lives are engaging on social media.
No, it's definitely a different era than when I would stick the cassette into my Walkman and hit play. And then when it was over, I would have to take it out and flip it over and play the other side. And part of that, as you say, are the algorithms that are driving information and the ubiquity of all these sorts of things and the way they're mixed together. But the other way they're different, and sort of to take the turn towards maybe a slightly more optimistic view of things, is that users have a chance to create their own messages. And you talk a little about earlier even about, you know, trying to find those more positive images. And I love the fact you've written about some of those efforts, particularly around body image and folks who are trying to foster messages and accounts that accept a wider spectrum of the human body. So I wonder if you'd talk a little about that work and how people are using social media to expand the conversation as opposed to restrict it.
Yeah, so I think you're talking about this this piece that I wrote that also was published in the academic journal Feminist Media Studies called Watch Out for the Big Girls,
yes.
Black Plus Size Content Creators Creating Space and Amplifying Visibility in Digital Spaces. And the reason why I wrote that is because really for a couple of reasons. So for one thing, when I think about how larger Black women are and have been represented in mainstream media, or just in media as a whole, we know that one of the primary ways and that we've seen big Black women show up in media is with the mammy stereotype, right? Which is this large, overweight Black woman who might have a deep brown skin tone, who is pretty much in service of white people and white families, and who is seen as asexual and not really a threat, and just this one-dimensional being. But then I think about, at the beginning of this century, in this new millennium, like around the year 2000, in Hollywood, some of the most prominent images that we saw of fat Black women were of Black men dressing up as fat Black women in fat suits. So I'm thinking about Eddie Murphy as Rasputia in Norbit, Martin Lawrence in Big Mama's House, 1, 2, and 3, Tyler Perry in all of the Madea films. So, and I mean, there at that time, you know, Queen Latifah, who now seems like a figure and a mainstay in media, but her existence is something that I couldn't have imagined growing up as a young Black girl in the 1980s. But I mean, even in that era, in the 1980s, in the early 2000s, there were plenty of large Black actresses who could have played those roles. But the fact that there were Black men in Hollywood who were content creators, who were using the sight of fat Black women's bodies as a place for comedy is something that stuck with me and never set well with me.
So maybe one of the upshot lessons of our conversation is the importance of encouraging people to take an active curatorial hand and develop a social media that gives them a view of the world, but also moments of joy and beauty and celebration. And speaking of which, as regular listeners of Pop Life will know, we always don't want to look deeper at our guests, not just as experts and folks who can help us think deeply about a topic, but also as folks who are curating their own form of joy. And we do that by asking a little bit about their pop culture interests. We usually begin that, Sherry, with a game we call the Fast Five. And here I have five questions drawn from broader social media. I'm going to ask you a series of questions that ask you to make a really tough either-or choice. We'll begin that with question number one. So, Sherry, I know you are a big Janet Jackson fan. So,
okay.
If you could only listen to one of her albums for the rest of your life, would it be 1986's Control or 1989's Rhythm Nation?
Control, hands down.
Okay, well, that was okay. Yeah. That was an easier question than I thought it'd be. Sherry, let's try question number two. After a long day of work, are you more likely to relax by scrolling through Twitter or flipping through Instagram?
Flipping through Instagram all day. That's awesome. Where the Black joy lives for me.
Awesome. I'm good. We now know the home, so that's very good. Question number three. So I'm going to do a little twist on both television and time travel, so follow along with me here. Would you rather return to fourth grade, but at Abbott Elementary, the popular ABC sitcom, or would you like to return to sophomore year of high school in HBO's Euphoria?
Oh, Abbott Elementary, hands down. Okay, first of all, I love Peter Brunson and that show, and Cheryl Lee Ralph. You mean to tell me if I could be in a school with Brunson and Ralph in the halls? And no, that, hands down. And also like Euphoria in the 10th grade, living through that? No, thanks. It's a great show, by the way. Love Zendaya and the crew, but no, Abbott Elementary all day. I think that's coming on, soon.
Yes.
I'm looking forward. I love that show.
Cocaine in Abbott Elementary. So question number four for you, Sherry.
Absolutely.
Who would you rather sit down for a cup of coffee and a chat? Would it be Missy Elliott or Queen Latifah?
Ooh, now that is hard. Oh, my God. Oh, that's so hard because I would love to talk to both of them. Ooh, because I grew up with Queen Latifah, but I love Missy. Okay, so can I have like a couple of sips with Missy and then maybe like 10 minutes with Missy and then 10 minutes with Latifah? Like, can we do that or do I have to make a choice?
Because we love you, and while Pop Life is a tough life, it's a fair life. We will allow you to have both because you've been such a great guest. So finally, question number five for you, Sherry, since I know you are a proud Syracuse University alum, who was the greatest number 44? Was it Ernie Davis or was it Jim Brown?
Ernie Davis.
Very easy, good question. You managed to get through all five questions and get both Missy Elliott and Queen Latifah. So finally, Sherry, a question for you. What are you loving? What are you watching? What are you listening to? What is in your pop culture life these days?
what's in my pop culture life these days, which is not quite back in it, but coming back into it, is P-Valley. It's this show on Stars that is based in Mississippi at this strip club. So it's a show that was written and developed by Katori Hall, who has done a lot of great work on Broadway. But I love this show because it's very Black. It's very Southern, very unapologetic in its expressions of queer Black people, Southern people. I just really love this show because I have not ever seen anything like this on television or really even in film either. This is a representation that I think is so very important because I know people like the people on P-Valley, and they deserve to be represented in media also. And this is one of the first times that I've seen people like this, Southern, Black, queer, just working class, represented in such a way that is complex and really embodies their humanity and also their flaws, faults, and mistakes. So P-Valley, I feel like I'm like, like giving a commercial for P-Valley right now. But the show, the second season, I'm so excited too because it's been a while. But the second season comes back to Stars this June. So I'm really, really excited about that. But right now I am obsessed with Abbott Elementary. I love that show. Like I said, I love the star of the show. And Tyler Williams, I think, I can't remember his full name right now, but the young man who played Chris on Everybody Hates Chris and Cheryl Lee Ralph. I mean, it just has a great ensemble cast. And the kids on there are so smart too. And they kind of remind me of like little kids in my own family who would like say these little smart things, like, you know, like smart as intelligent and smart as in like smart Alec. Like, I really love that show. But P-Valley is on my radar for the summer, and I'm excited that it's coming back. But Abbott Elementary is really on my mind right now.
Sherry, you have both been an amazing guest and insightful and thoughtful, and we really appreciate it. And you've given us great suggestions for all our DVRs that can be set to P-Valley. And, of course, we're already set to Abbott Elementary. And just finally, a reminder to our listeners, whether you find a particular development in popular culture disturbing or delightful, odds are that we'll be talking about it here on Pop Life. I'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to Pop Life, a production of WAER, Syracuse Public Media. You can find archived episodes at WAER.org, and don't forget to subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen for automatic delivery of new episodes.